And yet, because it was centrally controlled, and it wasn't a huge group of people in Japan at the time, it wasn't such a large population, but it was enough that it laid the basis for all the Japanese civilization that developed later. So that was an extraordinary amount. And I haven't studied European history, but if you think about the Roman soldiers who went and brought Latin and some things to the rest of Europe, I think it was, in a way, it's much deeper than that, because it covered such all phases of the civilization, which means that the roots of Japanese civilization, even today, are very deeply into Chinese. I talked to some Chinese who said they visited Japan for the first time. They said when they went to the stores and saw characters, even though the language had diverged, they felt kind of comfortable. They saw a lot of things that, you know, Buddhist temples and so forth, that had quite a feeling of comfort they could relate to, because it's sort of part of their civilization. So that's one great learning period, when Japanese civilization basically learned from China. The second period I'm going to talk about is from 1895 up to by 1931, 37, however you want to date the start of the Sino-Japanese War. And this period came out, of course, China learning from Japan, and it came from Japanese defeat in the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95. Until that time, Chinese had very little interest in Japan. They looked down at it as a little, four little islands a long way, it didn't matter. And I was reading one account of one of the people involved in the China trade at that time, who said that out of 1,000 Chinese, perhaps 999 would think that they would, if they went to war, China would defeat Japan in no time, and that wouldn't amount to anything. And so it was a rude shock to the Chinese that the Japanese defeated them in war. There were a small number of Chinese who'd begun to learn about Japan, but they hadn't known enough, and it was not common knowledge that Japan was beginning to industrialize. That was such a small group of people. The dominant view was those little, sometimes they call them dwarfs, the Japanese dwarfs. It's just a little island way off there, much like we might think of the South China Sea. In 1894, as a result of that attitude, the Chinese had very little knowledge of Japan. In 1877, the formal diplomatic relations between China and Japan were established for the first time. It'd be, you know, because of the contact with Westerners, more shipping and so forth, and the incoming Westerners forming treaties, so that China and Japan also formed a treaty. And the first mission that was sent to Japan was in 1877, and they established what was, you know, their, in fact, their embassy in Tokyo. And the number two person was a man named Huang Yongxian. And there's one of Fairbanks' Japanese students, Noriko Kamachi, had written a book about this guy. He had written, after he went to the embassy, he had meetings with the Japanese in Tokyo. And the Japanese, some of the meetings they had what they called brush conversations, because even though the common spoken language was different, they could write and then they would get the right answer. And some of the Japanese intellectuals at that time could speak Chinese, and certainly you could write very good Chinese. And they had wonderful parties they called brush parties, where they met. But Huang Yongxian, through these brush parties, got acquainted, and they told him all kinds of things about Japan. And he wrote a book, and it was quite a knowledgeable, for that time, it was probably the best book that a Chinese had written about Japan, describing the whole thing. There wasn't even enough interest in China to print the book or publish it. It was only published after the 1894-95. The Japanese, on the other hand, had begun in the 1860s and 70s to send trading missions and begin to train people to learn about trade in China. And there was a three-volume work, I forgot what year, in my book it tells what year, but there was a three-volume work in Japan for designed for commercial purposes, all the things you need to know about Japan, China, I mean, geography, location, maps, riverways, level of living, and so forth, a kind of wonderful guide. And they developed schools where they were in China that would train Japanese businessmen. So they had supplied quite a broad knowledge of China. Now the Chinese who look back at history say, well, the Japanese were planning to invade China. And ever since Hideyoshi invaded in the late 1500s, that the Japanese have been plotting and planning to invade. And the purpose of these books was to prepare the invasion. It is true that many of the people who took part in that writing of that book, which is basically meant for Japanese business people, later became spies in the 1894-95 war and provided local knowledge to the Japanese military. But I haven't been able to find enough evidence that they really plotted from an early period their desire to take over China. As Japan became stronger, there were military who began to have that ambition, but it was not a national organized plot any more than those of us who work on China see the Chinese today as having a plot to take over the whole world. I mean, there are some Chinese who probably think that way, but it's not an organized plot, and I haven't seen any evidence to show in late 19th century an organized plot. But there was information available to Japanese businessmen, so that by the time of the 1894-95 war, they broke out. Of course, the war broke out in Korea, and I try to explain the background of that in long detail, and this isn't the time to go into the great detail, but the quick thing is that Japanese began in the 1850s, tried to develop more trade with Korea, and began to move in, and one tried the Korean kingship was, royal family was quite divided and complicated. Some in the early 1880s had visited Japan, the gentleman's tour, where they were learning about modernization. Some had contact with China. And there were Chinese who had what they call suzerainty over Korea for a long period of time. And the Japanese beginning to move into trade. And there were tensions that developed and grew in the Korean Peninsula. And it was in Korea that the War of 1894 broke out, 1894-95, and the Japanese clearly started the war. Although there isn't evidence that they had a long time organized plot, they clearly started the war. And until 1895, therefore, the Chinese who had no interest in learning anything about Japan were suddenly confronted with the fact, whoa, this little country has modernized more than we have. And so you had already in 1898 some people saying, oh, we got to modernize quickly, and the Japanese through the Meiji Restoration have done so much and we got to move very quickly. But then there was the Russo-Japanese War in 1904 and 5, and the Chinese were saying to modernize, there were not enough modern schools in China, and the opportunity to learn modernity came from sending people to Japan. And of course, Sun Yat-sen, Yang Chi-chao, Kang Youwei, already in the early 1900s, even before the 1911 revolution, spent time in Japan, and were already thinking that Japan might provide ideas that China can develop. And I think, however, in contrast to the time, the first time period where there was organized Japanese effort to learn from China, it really was a disorganized effort. There were some organizations between the two countries that provided bridges. There were some places in Japan and China where Japanese teachers were invited in. There were a few organized tours of Chinese to go to Japan to see what was going on. But overwhelmingly, the learning was from individuals, often what you might call middle-class families, they could afford to send their kids overseas. It was easier to send them to Japan than it was to send them to Europe. Besides, there was more similarity in the language, and the Japanese had already selected a lot of Western works, put them in Japanese, which was much easier for the Chinese to learn. And they had selected things which might be useful for modernization. So in eight end, I think the ending of the examination system in China in 1905 meant that for families who are trying to get their sons educated, there was no longer a sense of preparing them for the classical Confucian examination. If you want to get in the modern world, you had to learn about modernity. It wasn't clear what modernity was and what sectors, but they sent to Japan all kinds of sectors. And virtually every different sector, there were Chinese who went to Japan. I think most people, there's a woman who lives in Washington, D.C., Paula, Paula Harrell. Is it Georgetown?
She teaches at Georgetown.
Georgetown, who has done the basic work. And she had done so much work on this period that for my chapter, I got her to collaborate with me. And the two of us wrote. I mean, she'd done all the basic research, and I tried to help give kind of an overall framework to that chapter. But the intellectual digging and hard work is something that she had done. But she describes the Chinese students going to Japan. In 1905, there were an estimated about 10,000 Chinese students in Japan. There were far more Chinese students in Japan at that era than students from any one country in any other country. It was a massive scale. Somehow the American students don't even know about that. I mean, that there were so many Chinese students. And in all areas, Chiang Kai-shek went there to study military. In the 1930s, most of the Chinese Kuomintang military leaders, I think a majority of the top leaders, had all studied in Japan military academies. And so you had an enormous group in the military. But it wasn't all nationalists. Joan Lai had studied in Japan, the communist leader. And there were other communists. If you look in science, medicine, agriculture, education, how to develop university courses, how do you develop teaching to study what the Japanese done, public administration, and also philosophy, art. And so many of the concepts, modern concepts in China really came through learning from Japan. You take the word socialism, shakai-shugi, and came from Japanese. The word communism came from Japanese. It was kyosanto, kumsanto. So they learned the concepts of the radicalism as well as more conservatism from Japan. And some of the people, many of you of Chinese background, know about the writer Lu Xun, who's a great modern writer. He went to Japan to study medicine, and the course decided that Japan was so far ahead of China that they needed to arouse the Chinese people, and therefore became a writer. His brother, Zhou Ren, became a leading writer. Guo Moruo, a leader, Yu Dafu. So the whole trend in modern Chinese literature of the 1920s was dominated by those who had gone to Japan and learned modern Japanese literature. So the broad scale of learning from Japan was really, it was extensive, it was deep, it was individual, it wasn't directed. It was, China was in such chaos after late 19th century, and particularly after the 1911 revolution, when there was no real national leadership, was not unified. Many of the warlords in China wanted to have relations with Japan and get their help for their particular group of people. So it was all over China that you had this massive infusion, but it was, as the Japanese would say, bara bara. You know, it was all which ways, all kinds of directions. It was not the kind of centrally organized, led learning that had taken place in the earlier period when Japan was learning. Then the third period I want to mention, you can date it from 1972, when China and Japan normalized relations again, or you could date maybe from 1978, the third plenum, when Deng Xiaoping came to power. But after the communists came to power in 1949, there was already some people who thought maybe they could begin to learn from Japan as well as from Russia. In 1955, at the Bandung Conference, Zhou Enlai took some initiatives to try to get the Japanese to take more interest in the Chinese economy. But because of the American-led occupation, the Americans restrained Japan and made it difficult for them to play a very large role in the Chinese economy at the time, until Kissinger and Nixon went to China. But once that happened, then the Japanese moved quickly to normalize relations in 72. And then after 78, a Treaty of Peace and Friendship, when they could begin to have deeper relations. By the late 1978, it was clear that Japan could be useful for Deng Xiaoping and others who wanted to lead the modernization effort. Hua Guofeng, who was Mao's successor in 76, already had a little bit interest. But in 1978, when it seemed like Deng might get heavier responsibilities, 2 months before the third plenum, from which we date reform and opening beginning as the big push to modern China, 2 months before that, Deng Xiaoping went to Japan, and he spent a week there. He tried to establish good relationships with the Japanese. Used the saying that when we dig a well, when we drink from the water, we remember who dug the well. He remembered that Tanaka Kakue was the one in 1972 who had led the normalization relations. But at the time, in the mid-70s, it was what we call the Lockheed scandal, where Tanaka Kakue got in trouble. He was under house arrest in 1978. Deng Xiaoping insisted on seeing him. He was allowed to go to see Tanaka Kakue and at his home. He expressed appreciation for what he had done to restore Sino-Japanese relations. When he went to the Kansai area, he met Takasaki Tatsunosuke's daughter. Takasaki had played a big role after 1947-48 in maintaining good relations in Manchuria with Chinese who wanted to take over Japanese industry. And also, he and Liao Chengzhi had a relationship that became kind of an underlying trade relationship between China and Japan that began to develop even before normalization in 1972, and larger relations in 78. So after 1978, what China was learning from Japan was heavily in economic industrial sector. And when Deng Xiaoping was already there, October, 2 months before the third plenum, he rode on the Japanese Shinkansen, the Kyoto. That was the fast train. At the time, most Chinese had no idea what the fast train even was. Today, as you know, about half the fast track in the world is in China. They have about as much mileage of fast train as all the world put together. The United States is not even in the ballgame. And in Japan, of course, the Shinkansen was new, and the idea of having high-speed train was very appealing, and Deng rode in that, and I was quite impressed and wanted to get that for China. There are three factory areas that he visited. I think they're especially important. One is the New Japan Steel had already begun to have contacts with Japanese steel builders in Shanghai to build the Baoshan steel plant. And Deng went to Kimitsu, just across the Tokyo Bay, which is then the most modern steel plant in the world, and became the model for what the Japanese call Hozan, Baoshan steel, which is the first modern steel plant. If I remember, 1 year during the Great Leap Forward, the annual steel production in China was about 13 million tons a year. Kimitsu did more than that in 1 year, one single plant. And Baoshan, by the time it got built, did even more than that. So learning modern steel, Deng visited, and Inayama, who was the head of Japan Steel at the time, was very willing and very appreciative. They had already developed had a relationship with Wuhan way back in the early 1900s, where they got some raw materials from Wuhan. And also, some years earlier, one of the smaller projects, in Japanese terms, but fairly large for China, was the repairing of the Wuhan steel plant. And in the New Japan Steel had already been involved in that. So it was quite natural there was a basis for relationship. But the plant that Deng visited became the model for Baoshan, the first great steel plant, which then became the model for other steel plants in China that could grow up and have modern steel. Another place he visited was Nissan. In the last year or so, Nissan's been a lot of trouble. But at that time, Nissan, along with Toyota, was one of the really modern places. I mean, using a lot of robots. One of the first places to introduce robots on the production line. And Deng went to visit, is it Kamiya? The steel plant, not far from Tokyo, at that time the Nissan plant. That plant then became a kind of a basis for helping introduce modern automobile production in China. Deng asked him how many cars does a worker produce a year, average worker? And they said, well, our figure is something like 94 or 95. So our figure is about one a year. The level of production was almost handicraft car production in Japan compared to a modern factory. So they learned modern factory. And Deng Xiaoping also went down to Osaka to meet Matsushita Konosuke, whom Deng referred to as the god of modern enterprise. This was a guy who had been in China some in the 1920s and had started out making bicycle bicycle lights in the 1920s, and then build up what became National Panasonic, one of the largest electronic makers in the world. And so it was a guy who had a contact with China already, and this is the age before computers and modern electronic hand phones and so forth.